2 Kings chapter 4 and 5. Now the wife of a member of the company of prophets cried to Elisha, "Your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that your servant feared the Lord, but a creditor has come to take my two children as slaves." Elisha said to her, "What shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in the house?" She answered, "Your servant has nothing in the house except a jar of oil." He said, "Go outside, borrow vessels from all your neighbors, empty vessels, and not just a few. Then go in and shut the door behind you and your children, and start pouring into all these vessels. When each is full, set it aside." So she left him and shut the door behind her and her children. They kept bringing vessels to her, and she kept pouring. When the vessels were full, she said to her son, "Bring me another vessel." But he said to her, "There are no more." Then the oil stopped flowing. She came and told the man of God, and he said, "Go sell the oil and pay your debts, and you and your children can live on the rest." One day Elisha was passing through Shunem, where a wealthy woman lived, who urged him to have a meal. So whenever he passed that way, he would stop there for a meal. She said to her husband, "Look, I am sure that this man who regularly passes our way is a holy man of God. Let us make a small roof chamber with walls and put there for him a bed, a table, a chair, and a lamp, so that he can stay there whenever he comes to us." One day when he came there, he went up to the chamber and lay down there. He said to his servant Gehazi, "Call the Shunammite woman." When he had called her, she stood before him. He said to him, "Say to her, 'Since you have taken all this trouble for us, what may be done for you? Would you have a word spoken on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army?'" She answered, "I live among my own people." He said, "What then may be done for her?" Gehazi answered, "Well, she has no son, and her husband is old." He said, "Call her." When he had called her, she stood at the door. He said, "At this season, in due time, you shall embrace a son." She replied, "No, my lord, O man of God, do not deceive your servant." The woman conceived and bore a son at that season, in due time, as Elisha had declared to her. When the child was older, he went out one day to his father among the reapers. He complained to his father, "Oh, my head, my head!" The father said to his servant, "Carry him to his mother." He carried him and brought him to his mother. The child sat on her lap until noon, and he died. She went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God, closed the door on him, and left. She called to her husband and said, "Send me one of the servants and one of the donkeys, so that I may quickly go to the man of God and come back again." He said, "Why go to him today? It is neither new moon nor Sabbath." She said, "It will be all right." Then she saddled the donkey and said to her servant, "Urge the animal on. Do not hold back from me unless I tell you." So she set out and came to the man of God at Mount Carmel. When the man of God saw her coming, he said to Gehazi, his servant, "Look, there is the Shunammite woman. Run at once to meet her and say to her, 'Are you all right? Is your husband all right? Is the child all right?'" She answered, "It is all right." When she came to the man of God at the mountain, she caught hold of his feet. Gehazi approached to push her away, but the man of God said, "Let her alone, for she is in bitter distress. The Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me." Then she said, "Did I ask my Lord for a son? Did I not say, 'Do not mislead me'?" He said to Gehazi, "Gird up your loins and take my staff in your hand and go. If you meet anyone, give no greeting, and if anyone greets you, do not answer, and lay my staff on the face of the child." Then the mother of the child said, "As the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So he rose up and followed her. Gehazi went on ahead and laid the staff on the face of the child, but there was no sound or sign of life. He came back to meet him and told him, "The child has not awakened." When Elisha came into the house, he saw the child lying dead on his bed. So he went and closed the door on the two of them and prayed to the Lord. He got up on the bed and lay upon the child, putting his mouth upon his mouth, his eyes upon his eyes, and his hands upon his hands. And while he lay bent over him, the flesh of the child became warm. He got down, walked once to and fro in the room, then got up again and bent over him. The child sneezed seven times, and the child opened his eyes. Elisha summoned Gehazi and said, "Call the Shunammite woman." So he called her. When she came to him, he said, "Take your son." She came and fell at his feet, bowing to the ground. Then she took her son and left. When Elisha returned to Gilgal, there was a famine in the land. As the company of prophets was sitting before him, he said to his servant, put the large pot on and make some stew for the company of the prophets. One of them went out into the field to gather herbs. He found a wild vine and gathered from it a lap full of wild gourds and came and cut them up into the pot of stew, not knowing what they were. They served some for the men to eat, but when they were eating the stew, they cried out, "O man of God, there is death in the pot." They could not eat it. He said, "Then bring some flour." He threw it into the pot and said, "Serve the people and let them eat." And there was nothing harmful in the pot. A man came from Baal Shalishah, bringing food from the first fruits to the man of God, 20 loaves of barley and fresh ears of grain in his sack. Elisha said, "Give it to the people and let them eat." But his servant said, "How can I set this before 100 people?" So he repeated, "Give it to the people and let them eat. For thus says the Lord, they shall eat and have some left." He set it before them, they ate, and had some left, according to the word of the Lord. Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Aram, was a great man and in high favor with his master, because by him the Lord had given victory to Aram. The man, though a mighty warrior, suffered from leprosy. Now the Arameans, on one of their raids, had taken a young girl captive from the land of Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "If only my lord were with the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." So Naaman went in and told his lord just what the girl from the land of Israel had said. And the king of Aram said, "Go then, and I will send along a letter to the king of Israel." He went, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of garments. He brought the letter to the king of Israel, which read, "When this letter reaches you, know that I have sent to you my servant Naaman, so that you may cure him of his leprosy." When the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes and said, "Am I God to give death or life that this man sends word to me to cure a man of his leprosy? Just look and see how he is trying to pick a quarrel with me." But when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, he sent a message to the king, "Why have you torn your clothes? Let him come to me, that he may learn that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman came with his horses and chariots and halted at the entrance of Elisha's house. Elisha sent a messenger to him, saying, "Go, wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored, and you shall be clean." But Naaman became angry and went away, saying, "I thought that for me he would surely come out and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, and would wave his hand over the spot and cure the leprosy. Are not Abana and Parfar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean?" He turned and went away in a rage. But his servants approached and said to him, "Father, if the prophet had commanded you to do something difficult, would you not have done it? How much more when all he said to you was, 'Wash and be clean'?" So he went down and immersed himself 7 times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God. His flesh was restored like the flesh of the young boy, and he was clean. Then he returned to the man of God, he and all his company. He came and stood before him and said, "Now I know that there is no God in all the earth except in Israel. Please accept a present from your servant." But he said, "As the Lord lives, whom I serve, I will accept nothing." He urged him to accept, but he refused. Then Naaman said, "If not, please let 2 mule loads of earth be given to your servant, for your servant will no longer offer burnt offering or sacrifice to any god except the Lord. May the Lord pardon your servant on one count. When my master goes into the house of Rimmon to worship there, leaning on my arm, and I bow down in the house of Rimmon, when I do bow down in the house of Rimmon, may the Lord pardon your servant on this one account." He said to him, "Go in peace." But when Naaman had gone from him a short distance, Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, thought, "My master has let that Aramean Naaman off too lightly by not accepting from him what he offered. As the Lord lives, I will run after him and get something out of him." So Gehazi went after Naaman. When Naaman saw someone running after him, he jumped down from the chariot to meet him and said, "Is everything all right?" He replied, "Yes, but my master has sent me to say, 2 members of a company of prophets have just come to me from the hill country of Ephraim. Please give them 1 talent of silver and 2 changes of clothing." Naaman said, "Please accept 2 talents. He urged him and tied up 2 talents of silver and 2 bags with 2 changes of clothing and gave them to 2 of his servants who carried them in front of Gehazi. When he came to the citadel, he took the bags from them and stored them inside. He dismissed the men and they left. He went in and stood before his master, and Elisha said to him, 'Where have you been, Gehazi?' He answered, 'Your servant has not gone anywhere at all.' But he said to him, "Did I not go with you in spirit when someone left his chariot to meet you? Is this a time to accept money and to accept clothing, olive orchards and vineyards, sheep and oxen, and male and female slaves? Therefore the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and to your descendants forever." So he left his present leprous as white as snow. The word of the Lord. Now, savor this, because as we get into 2 Kings, we're going to get back into the grand old rhythm of bad kings doing bad things and lots of war and violence and skullduggery. So, a widow of one of the company of prophets gathered around Elisha calls to him, and her husband's died, and that puts her in a very difficult bind, because she can't meet the debts. And a way of settling debts in Torah, specifically in Leviticus chapter 25, verses 39 through 43, is that, yes, your children can be enslaved as a way of remitting your debts. Of course, there's other evidence to the contrary in places like Exodus 22, verse 2, or Deuteronomy chapter 10, verses 18 through 19, just to mention a few of the many examples that we could cite from the Torah. God says that He cares for the widows and for the orphans. And so if this is true, then how could it possibly be just and godly to enslave children in order to reclaim a debt? Elisha fixes this for her in a way somewhat similar to what Elijah did in 1 Kings chapter 17, verses 8 through 16, where Elijah, this woman and her son, had just enough food for one more meal, and they were going to eat that and then starve to death. And he manages to replenish her supplies so that not only she and her son can eat, but he can too. And that was done for a foreigner by Elisha. And in his prophetic time, he predominantly worked among the Gentiles, as you may remember, as a way of symbolizing Yahweh's presence being taken away from Israel because of their idolatry. Elisha, on the other hand, does work in Gentile territory, as we've heard, but predominantly his work is done in Israel. And this partly reflects their different roles. Elijah confronts power. He's the guy that gets Jezebel so mad at him that she's put out a hit order on him because he slaughtered 450 prophets of Baal. Elisha is one who sort of, by the abundant mercy of God working through him and providing for the people, he sort of co-opts the monarchy because people had been relying on the priests and on the kings for their security, for their prosperity, to act as intermediaries with their relationship with God. For the remainder of 2 Kings, that responsibility is going to fall to the prophets, almost exclusively, because the corruption of the monarchy has become so great that, you know, the kings themselves aren't right with God. How could they possibly help their nation be right with God, particularly in the northern kingdom? And so by providing them with the basic necessities of life, by rescuing her sons, this part of chapter 4 demonstrates how God's abundant life is just pouring through Elisha, confirming him as a rightful prophet who should be listened to. And of course, we'd be remiss if we didn't note that Elisha told this woman what to do, didn't explain what was going to happen, just told her, borrow all the empty jars you can, and then start pouring from your oil jar into those empty jars. And she does it. So she works on incomplete information. She doesn't know why she's been told to do this or how it's going to turn out. But because a prophet speaking the word of God told her to do it, she did, and she benefited from it greatly. In verse 8, we transition to Elisha traveling in Shunem, and she offers him hospitality and even set up a sort of a little attic room for him so that when he passed by, he could stay there instead of the Motel 6. And so he stops by on his travels and wants to know what he can do for her, since she's done so much for him. And he sends Gehazi to inquire. Good delegator, Elisha. Almost never goes to see anybody or receive somebody into his presence without Gehazi sort of taking the temperature first. And her response in the second half of verse 13 is interesting. I live among my own people. And, you know, you could see this as a sign of independence, but when you look at it in the context of what she's done for Elisha, you know, she probably doesn't see herself as a worthy recipient of a gift because she's a foreigner. And Gehazi comes back and he says, well, you know, she didn't mention anything, but I know that she's childless and her husband's pretty old. And Elisha summons her and says, you're going to have a child. And that reminds me of when the angelic messengers came to Abraham and Sarah and said, you're going to have a child even though you two are ancient. And of course Sarah laughed at that. And this woman said, please don't tease me, that's not funny. I mean, you're dealing with a very painful issue in a very cavalier way. But she did receive a son, as Abram and Sarah did, as Mary did. And as the child got older, he was out in the fields with his dad and the workers, and he gets a headache. And so his dad sends him into the house to his mother, and he died. So she takes his body and puts it on Elisha's bed, which is interesting because, you know, having any contact with dead bodies was a taboo, not just in Israelite culture, but in other ancient Near Eastern cultures. And then she calls out to her husband and says, I need servants, I need a donkey, I've got to go see Elisha. And it's intriguing because she has this great sense of urgency, as does Elisha, as we'll see later in the passage. But the father is just kind of like, well, it's not the new moon, it's not the Sabbath, why are you going? Oh, and by the way, our son just died. And so obviously she doesn't have a similar type of experience in terms of her awareness of who Elisha is and what he's capable of by God. So they hustle out to Mount Carmel. And, you know, these geographical citations are rarely, if ever, coincidental. You know, as you remember, Mount Carmel is where Elijah fought with the prophets of Baal, and where he saw the rain coming in from the sea. So Elisha sees her coming and sends Gehazi to kind of close the distance. And, you know, is everything okay? Because it's not a Sabbath, it's not a new moon, so she's not coming on the regular schedule. So he realizes something might be wrong. And it's odd because at the last of verse 26, she tells Gehazi it's all right when it isn't. But when she gets to Elisha, she falls at his feet. Gehazi tries to push her away. She's a Gentile, shouldn't be touching him. And Elisha says, hey, something's going on. God hasn't shared it with me. And she says, I told you not to mislead me. And you've given me a son, and now he's dead, which is more cruel than if you'd never given me a son at all. And he tells Gehazi to load up and go ahead to their house and use a staff to try to raise the child. And it intrigues me why Elisha wouldn't go himself. And Gehazi does his best, but his best is basically jack. And so he goes back and tells Elisha. So Elisha goes, and in a very, very similar way to what Elijah does to raise the child in 1 Kings chapter 17. He lays down on the child, again, breaking all the violations about having physical contact with a dead body. And a little bit more elaborate, you have him sort of pacing the room after the body's warmed up, and the child sneezing seven times. And, of course, that's going to reappear with Naaman, who's going to have to dunk himself in the River Jordan seven times. And, of course, that's a sacred number because Seven are the number of the days of creation, the seventh day being the Sabbath, the holiest day of the week, a day of rest, a day of peace. He brings him back from the dead. So again, new life, new birth, and the defeat of death, that power is carried through the prophets in sharp contrast to the kings, who increasingly only manage to bring death and misery and old ways of being to their people. The last couple of stories in 4 deals with food. He goes back to Gilgal, and there's famine, and his fellow prophets need something to eat, so he says, well, let's just make kind of a stew. And one guy who failed botany went out and ended up collecting some poisonous herbs and dumped that in the pot. Or maybe if he was just really ambitious and he thought, oh, if I kill all the rest, you know, I'll be the only prophet left. Probably just failed botany. So they taste it and they realize that they can't eat it. And very similar to the way that Elijah healed the water, purified the water at Jericho in 2 Kings chapter 2, verses 19 through 22. Elijah throws some flour in and purifies this poisonous stew. And then the second feeding story is somebody comes in with the first fruits. And it's interesting that normally the first fruits of the harvest would be taken to an altar of God, whether it was the temple in Jerusalem or maybe to some place like Bethel, and offered there. But here they're brought to Elisha, which just emphasizes the degree to which the priests and the kings have fallen out of favor, and the prophets are the locus of religious authority during this time period. And Elisha said, pass it out so people can eat. But it's not nearly enough. The people outnumber the loaves by 5 to 1. We're not talking about one of those ginormous loaves of bread that we, you know, buy at the bakery section of the grocery store. I mean, these would have been, you know, smaller. And without talking about how it happened or really elaborating on it at all, the man follows Elisha's instructions, ridiculous as they were, and somehow an inordinate number of people were able to eat from a relatively small number of loaves. And of course, that's a precursor to the feeding miracles that Jesus did. And so this part of chapter 4, again, all of it is trying to demonstrate the power of Elisha and God's ability to purify and provide abundantly to the people. We move into chapter 5, and you've got Naaman, who was a general of Aram, and you talk about the ultimate outsider. It's possible that he was in charge of the troops who defeated Israel at Ramoth-Gilead back in 1 Kings chapter 22, verses 19 through 23. And, you know, we had talked about in Samuel and in the early part of 1 Kings that the principal enemy of Israel were the Philistines. But during this specific time period, it was the Arameans who really caused them fits. And you see that in 1 Kings chapter 20 and 22, 2 Kings chapter 6 through 7. But remember, victories that are achieved by Gentiles are granted by God as a way to punish the people and perhaps try to wake them up to the fact that they're putting their hopes into false gods. And victory comes only through God. Ironically, it's a captive that they took from this battle as spoils, who says to Naaman's wife, you know, he should go to Elisha because he's pretty good at this whole healing leprosy thing. And for some reason, the king listens to this, but decides to have his king send a letter to the king of Israel first to sort of set it up. I mean, they weren't on the best of terms. So before you go barging into enemy territory, you want to sort of, you know, line things up so you're not killed or taken prisoner. You know, get safe passage, I think is what they call it. And the king of Israel, who's not specified at this time, but is probably Jehoram, thinks that this is a ruse, that they're trying to find some sort of pretext to go back to war with them. And he just, it's pitiful, really. You know, he tears his clothes and he's like, oh, why is he coming to kill me? And again, this is just, you know, a contrast. You know, the king's faithless fear compared to Elisha, and even more shockingly, Naaman's faith. I mean, Naaman's willing to give it a go. He has no reason to respect Elisha, but, you know, maybe he's desperate and he's willing to try anything. Elisha finds out that the king is kind of throwing a pity party, and he says, listen, I can handle this, just send him to me. Naaman really loads up, lots of silver, lots of gold, and kind of a closet of clothes. And again, Elisha, instead of meeting him initially, sends Gehazi, who says, you got to wash in the Jordan 7 times. And Naaman gets pretty huffy about that. There's a personal pride being revealed here, and there's a nationalistic pride being revealed here. He wanted something really fancy. You know, he thought, well, isn't Elisha supposed to come out and do a dance and, you know, lay hands on me and shout to heaven and, you know, jump in a river, give me a break. We've got better rivers where I came from. But his servants say to him, listen, this is easy, so why don't you give it a shot? You know, he's not asking you to undergo surgery. He just wants you to take some vitamins, so swallow them. And he goes into Jordan, immersing himself 7 times, again a symbolic number, and it says his flesh was restored like the flesh of a young boy, and he was clean. And this is very much a symbol of rebirth, of new life, and of baptism. Christians didn't invent baptism. John the Baptist offered a specific type of baptism in the wilderness, but it existed prior to then, not just in Judaism, but in other traditions, as a central initiation event, either part of a package or maybe the culminating event in someone converting from one religion to another, or somebody being initiated into a mystery cult or something like that. So this is not acronistic to say that this was a baptismal event. So he goes back to Elisha and acknowledges the reality of Yahweh as supreme, not the only God, but supreme. Now I know that there is no God in all the earth except in Israel. And he tries to give him some money and some clothes, and he's like, no way. And maybe it's because Elisha doesn't want to accept tribute from a foreigner. He's willing to help out, but not sort of level the debt, if you will. And it also may be that the grace of God can't be bought. And that's a misunderstanding on Naaman's fault. And Naaman says, well, okay, can I have 2 mule loads of dirt? Which is kind of weird. And the best that we can make of it is that the pantheon of gods in the ancient world were associated with and sometimes identified with natural reality. So you had a sky god who was responsible for rain. You have people like Neptune who's responsible for the sea. You have people who are responsible for fertility in all its many guises, and on and on and on and on. And so he thought that to worship God properly when he went back to his home, he would need some of the soil of Israel to stand on to do that. Kind of like when a vampire travels, they have to have dirt in the coffin to lay on from their own native land. We don't know if Elijah said, yeah, start digging, that's fine by me. Because Naaman presses on to say, now, you know, I do have some official duties. The king goes on to Rimmon, goes in to worship Rimmon, I have to go in with him. And so I hope that that's okay. I'm really sorry about it, but it's my job. And Elisha sort of implicitly allows that by telling him to go in peace. He doesn't chide him for that or say no. He doesn't say yes either. So they go back home, and Gehazi is pretty upset because he's gotten away very cheaply. And it's sort of a contrast between Elijah's grace and mercy and Gehazi's prejudice and hatred and greed. So he runs after Naaman and concocts this story that two prophets have come in from Ephraim, and so we need some money. And Naaman bids him up from one talent of silver to two, and he comes back, he hides them, and Elisha confronts him. Where have you been? Oh, I've not been anywhere. And he's like, yeah, you have. I don't need my eyes to see. My spirit goes with you. He says, is this a time to accept money and to accept clothing, olive orchards and vineyards, sheep and oxen, and male and female slaves? You know, this isn't a racket. This isn't something we cash in on. This is something that we do purely for the glory of God. And he curses him, sort of transferring the leprosy of Naaman onto Gehazi, and at the same time saying, oh, and by the way, all of your children are going to inherit this. And, you know, just a reminder, leprosy is not Hansen's disease. Leprosy back then could be any skin disorder. It could be alopecia or you name it, acne maybe. All of those were signs of uncleanness. Until they were healed, there were restrictions on what you could do. And this story with Naaman in chapter 5 shows God's inclusivity when it comes to fulfilling his purposes through Gentiles. And this would have been a helpful explanatory narrative to people who had been conquered and carted off into exile, into slavery. Because, you know, if God's for us, then how could the Assyrians and the Babylonians have beat us this badly? Has God abandoned us? Has God let us down? Oh, but, you know, remember that time when Naaman went to Elisha? Or when Elisha gave the Shunammite woman a son? And then rose him from the dead, you know, and that sort of gives them a context to see hints of what's to come. And that way, looking backward at it in time, they can say, so God's been doing this in relatively subtle ways over and over and over again, in part because at the heart of the covenant is that we'll be a light to all nations, that all nations will come to know the glory of God and worship him. And we failed to be that light because we walked away from God in our idolatry and in our injustice, we failed in upholding our part of the covenant. And this is why. So, what are you guys seeing that I'm not? And you got any questions, I'll do my best to answer, but no guarantees there, ever.
Elisha sees it. More active in doing prophetic or not doing miraculous things with Elijah.
Well, it's different. Yeah, it's a little different. You know, he starts out with terrible violence. Elisha does fireballs on top of two companies, 50 men. But he does perform more miracles than Elijah by a substantial majority. But Elijah was, on the whole, harsher. Each of them does acts of mercy, and each of them confronts power in different ways. But Elisha was a kinder, gentler version of Elijah. I think that it's we're on the second generation of a new wave of prophets in Elisha, and this demonstrates the power of God working through them, and the fact that the other institutions are totally defunct, and this now is the locus of Israelite religion. It has to be, because they don't have anything else. Because remember, they're in exile. The temple's been destroyed. They're not even in the land anymore. So Elisha shows the goodness of God, received twice by Gentiles in this context, with a little mention of the king who just has no clue. You know, it's like he'd forgotten there was a guy named Elisha, or if he remembered him, didn't believe there was much that he could do, despite all that he'd already done.
I'm also struck by the similarity of these miracles, some of the miracles that Jesus did.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was an Elisha figure, and probably among the miracles Jesus did, those were selected, because it's quite likely that Jesus did other miracles that simply weren't included within the Gospels, because the miracles differ somewhat in the synoptics, and certainly with John, in terms of number of miracles relative to length of text, and the miracles themselves, they're fairly different. Like the changing of the water into the wine is only found in John. It's not found in the synoptics. And of course, John deploys that for his own specific purposes in revealing the truth of God in Christ. So anytime you write anything, you can't include it all.
So the fact that the gospel writers included Jesus' miracles that was so reminiscent of Elijah and Elisha's, mm-hmm. is further proof that Jesus is who he says he is.
Yeah, I think it was purposeful. They're lining him up with Elijah and Elisha because he is, among other things, a prophet who carries the word of God and who creates abundance and the opportunity for new life, for new birth. And the expectation in Judaism, the messianic expectation, had begun to center around Elijah in particular, because he was removed bodily into heaven. He didn't die in the conventional sense. As the centuries go by, they sort of start to... They're still looking for a Davidic figure, but they think that will be embodied in the return of Elijah. They're definitely trying to draw the connection right down to when Jesus asked the disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" They think you're Elijah. But Jesus is more than Elijah, because that's not the right answer.
What supper ceremony do they have a chair for Elijah, empty chair?
Well, they're waiting for him to return. Yes. They have an empty chair for Elijah, and that's a symbol of their hope that he will return, but also poignantly a symbol that he hasn't returned because the chair remains empty. But perhaps you could interpret it as Elijah being present in spirit, as he was with Gehazi, when Gehazi was ripping off Naaman. So. Yeah, that may be why the husband doesn't understand why she's going, when she's going, or why she has this intensity around it. But one would think that the word would have traveled pretty fast. She's lugging a dead body around. She has house servants, because she's wealthy. It's hard to believe that the father didn't know. But perhaps he didn't, and that's why he's confused by her behavior. I think that's probably the implicit contrast. And And again, you have to remember the gender roles in society 3,000 years ago. It was a very patriarchal culture. The reason that the widow was in such dire straits when her husband died was there's no legitimate way for women to earn money because they couldn't own property. So widows and orphans were very vulnerable, and which is why God repeatedly says, I'm the protector of widows and orphans, and this is how you should treat them. But, you know, the Torah, like all else in the Bible, comes from a variety of different sources, and a lot of the law in Leviticus is designed to regulate communal relations. And so what do you do when a guy dies and he's got a lot of debt and, you know, the wife can't pay you back? Well, you can take her children as slaves. Of course, the Bible also declares Jubilee every seventh year, and a grand Jubilee, if you will, every 50th year, which is the year after the seven times seventh year. And, of course, again, representing the Sabbath, representing restoration, debts would be canceled. The ground would be allowed to lay fallow that year as a symbol of the earth itself resting. We don't know if that was ever actually practiced. There's no evidence that it was. And you would think that if such a wondrous thing happened in a national economy that somebody would bother to write something down about it. But there's no evidence, biblical or non-biblical, archaeological, that the Jubilee was ever followed. But even for those who were enslaved, in Jubilee years, they were granted their freedom. Now, they could then be re-enslaved in the next year, but, you know, they were allowed at least a temporary freedom, was the idea.
When we were in Greece, where were we? Was it at Delphi? There were on the stones were names of freemen, mm-hmm. who every seventh year slaves were freed.
Mm. Interesting. Greece, huh. And were these Judaic inscriptions at Delphi?
No.
Okay.
Okay. So they were at a later time.
Yes. So potentially there was a similar practice in Gentile cultures.
And the Jubilee year, I was just talking with
Kathy.
I do it all the time. I'm so glad you do it. The Jubilee year is different for everybody. I mean, so when does this Jubilee year start? You know, what if you're born in the first part of that seventh, or the last part?
Yeah.
Then that made me think of the landlord who paid his servants different,
yeah.
or paid them the same, even though they came at different times to serve. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a Jubilee year there in a little nutshell.
Yeah, it's... It would be a wondrous practice, but unfortunately an immensely chaotic one.
Yeah.
And potentially a dangerous one, because presumably if you're going to allow the land to lie fallow, you're going to have to store up food for that to last you that seventh year. And what if your harvest isn't very good in the year or two before that? Well, how do you cope? So I think that the Jubilee was an ideal that illustrated the best of justice with mercy. But from a purely pragmatic perspective, it's hard to imagine. But of course, maybe the standard was set to say that your justice, your mercy is incomparable to God's, because it is a practical impossibility to do this, but it's the standard that God holds. And that's the promise that we share, that we'll all be liberated from the power of sin.
And then, you know, I wonder how her faith was, because she kind of says to that I should totally then raise my hopes.
Yeah.
So I mean, has she come to say, thanks, buddy, I didn't want this?
Well, I mean, I think she's a mother in mourning. She's desperate. And the fact that she sought after Elisha, you know, I don't think that she'd have the same sense of urgency if the only purpose was to give him what for. You know, I just see this as a cri de coeur, very much like what you see in the majority of the Psalms, where people cry out to God and, you know, why is this awful thing happening to me? And can't you make it better? So it's not explicit in the text, but one would think that with her prior experience of Elisha, she might have held out some meager hope that there might be something that they could do.
Michael?
Yeah.
Gehazi really that clueless throughout? Or is Gehazi more of a literary tool to show how clueless Israel was?
Right. Yeah, I think that, you know, you got a lot of Gehazi in here and really none of it's good. And you have to ask, you know, does Elisha need some help from HR? Because he's obviously made a really bad hire. And keeps him on. I think that you could maybe read in that, you know, here's Gehazi. He's Elisha's servant, you know, presumably with him day and night. So if anybody should know better, it should be Gehazi. And so how much more then is someone like a king to whom the prophets stand in opposition, how much more so then would the king remain clueless and prone to punishment for greed and enmity and to presume that you could profit from a work of God? Because that's what idolatry is all about. Pagan religion is very practical. It's an exchange mechanism. It's a transactional relationship. You know, I go into a store and I give pieces of paper to somebody, or put a piece of plastic into a machine so I can get a 10-pound bag of Red Hots. That's what I want for Christmas, by the way, is a 10-pound bag of Red Hots. You know, so it's very much the same way. You give sacrifices at designated sacred places, and you construct those sacred places in the first place in order to appease or leverage a god. And it's not quite that direct in Judaic cultic practices, but there's certainly something there. You know, right down to this, these are the animals and the number of animals you have to sacrifice in order to be purified from this sin and be reconciled to God.
That's not so far off from the Catholic Church of 60 years ago with indulgence.
Well,
if you said the rosary so many times, you got so many years off your time in purgatory.
Yeah, it's a works righteousness would be the Reformation term for that. And of course, when you go into the latter prophets, especially Isaiah, is this the sacrifice I desire? Well, hell no, because you're just pretending. You're just pretending. You don't worship me. I desire a humble and contrite heart. I desire justice and mercy. You know, and yeah, maybe if you do those things, then it's worthwhile for you to come and make sacrifices. But otherwise, you're just pretending to be in a covenant with me. You're just going through the motions. It's all surface level with nothing underneath. So there is this tension between a very elaborate cultic system with a tremendous amount of focus on the temple, with these exilic prophets saying there's no point in any of that if you can't adhere to the core of the covenant. You know, in a way, this is just the sacramental system, which is the outward and visible sign of the inward and spiritual grace. So, did you have your hand up? No. Okay. Jane.
You know, I do all my genealogy research. I had all these past ministers in my family when I was going through one of the old Bibles, and it was from the 1700s.
Wow.
And he was a minister, and I found this thing that he had written. And it was called A Little Wisdom to Remember. And I thought maybe you all would like to hear.
Yeah, please.
It's yesterday's past, tomorrow's the future, but today, I have to replace it. But today is a gift. That's why they call it the present.
Oh, I like that. That's pretty cool. Today's a gift, and that's why they call it the present. Yeah.
And I just thought that had so much meaning to it.
Absolutely.
To be written back in the 1700s.
Yeah.
That it's something that's has gone goes through life.
Well,
so I thought we all like and for it to be written a little ways to
yeah,
remember.
Indeed.
So I thought I'd bring that to you all.
Thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
Where did these prophets, I understand now they're replacing priests and kings where there's the corruption. But when you think back, you know, you go back to Samuel, there were schools of prophets, weren't there?
And it's like, yeah.
Where do these guys come from? Because they're not in, you don't have that in Leviticus? Do you have a...
No, the prophets emerge in, well, Moses was regarded as a prophet. And, you know, the tradition has that he authored all five books of the Torah, although that's a more symbolic rather than literal reality, just based on textual criticism and the fact that at the end of Deuteronomy, Moses somehow writes about his own death and burial. Prophecy emerged and developed over time. It was all intricately related to revealing the will of God through word, whether that be the Ten Commandments or whether it be oracles, and also demonstrating it through deeds of power, through signs. And what you have, starting with Samuel and moving on to Elisha and Elijah, and is an evolution of the role of the prophet. And it's when you get into the latter prophets, where you have the predictions of disaster, the accusation which supplies the reason why, the reflection on what could be done in order to repent and be restored, and then you know, a sense of promise and hope in most of the latter prophets that God will cause things to come around right, and in part because they eventually were released from Babylon and reoccupied the promised land. Some of them did, at least. So you have, especially in the last third of Isaiah, this real focus on promise that God will have mercy and there will be restoration. And so when you get to Elijah and Elisha, the role of the prophet, you get a little bit of it in Samuel, but you know, Samuel's kind of a transitional figure between judge and priest and prophet, because he's participating in the anointing of kings. Samuel occasionally exercises priestly duties, and you can sort of see a hint of that with Elijah as well in his competition with the prophets of Baal. But as the monarchy grows more and more corrupt, the prophets come into sharper definition in terms of what role they're playing for God. It's a revolutionary role that they play.
It looks like they lived in communities by themselves, you know, like, or something, like schools of the prophets or something.
Yeah, we've seen that as early as Saul when, you know, mm-hmm. he got caught up with a band of prophets who were in an ecstasy, and probably, you know, dancing around and chanting. And, you know, Elijah, you know, moans and groans about being the only prophet left, even though I think it was two groups of 50 prophets had been hidden in caves and provided with their needs by a senior ranking member of the royal court. And definitely when you look at Elisha, there is kind of a congregation of prophets, if you will, with him as the head. In fact, he was established as the head of this band of prophets by pursuing Elijah, despite everybody telling him not to, and by asking for a double portion of the Spirit, and by retrieving the mantle, which was the symbol of Elijah's authority. And so in different parts of the history of God's people, the prophets have played different roles as the need arose. And go ahead, Daryl.
Doesn't it seem like Elijah and Elisha were similar but different?
Yeah.
Elijah seemed more like flamboyant, maybe.
Yeah.
And Elisha's, his miracles are in general gentler.
Yeah. Well,
Yeah.
Apart from the she bear thing and the great balls of fire.
He's supposed to be more maybe Christ-like.
You know, there. One of the commentaries I'm reading suggests that Elijah is the prototype for John the Baptist, and that Elisha is the prototype for Jesus, and I can see that. But there's also a lot of overlap. And but I would see Elisha as a prophet that more consistently shows mercy. He even helps the kings. You know, they Jehoshaphat says, "Well, let's talk to a good prophet," and they bring up Elijah, and he sort of gives them that slightly deceptive prophecy. Yeah, it's all going to be fine, but you're going to do these things which turn out not to be fine. This is back in chapter 3. And, you know, they're out of water. And, you know, he says, don't worry. You have plenty of water in the morning. And, of course, that has the added benefit of deceiving the Moabites and causing them to recklessly, you know, go in thinking they're going to retrieve spoils, where, in fact, they wind up in a battle that they lose. Big time.
These prophets.
Yeah.
I've been arguing with her about these prophets. Are these prophets selected by the head, like Elisha? Did he select the prophets, or did they just band together?
You know, it's not sure how a prophet was identified.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously with Elisha receiving the mantle of Elijah, but this company of prophets, I think that like the named prophets, they demonstrated a truth within them and a power within them, possibly to work signs, that just sort of it's kind of like I can't remember who it was, somebody in Congress, and when they were talking about pornography laws, and they were struggling to define it, and he says, well, I know it when I see it, which I thought was a marvelously revelatory thing on his behalf, a bit of unintentional vulnerability. You know, and I think prophets are, you know, much the same way. I mean, you can, there are certain people you can just feel, and they have a presence about them, and you're aware that you are in the presence of a man or a woman of God. Like our presiding bishop, when you're with Michael Curry, it's just different. You know, you're experience somebody whose faith is self-evident, and the man, you know, doesn't have to say Jesus this and Jesus that. You know, Desmond Tutu is the same way. I mean, he's a short guy, really short. And in fact, he's so short that when he came to VTS, they actually had to construct a little podium for him to stand on, a little pedestal for the podium. But he can walk into a crowded room and you just know that he's there. You just feel it in the air.
In the church in South Charleston, West Virginia, there was a man that everybody looked to, and they really kind of assigned him roles that he really wasn't qualified for. But the reason they did was he was a man of faith. He was definitely a man of faith that everybody knew. This was a man of faith, and he was totally respected. And because of that, they expected him to do all sorts of other things that he really wasn't gifted to do.
Yeah.
I just want to put a word in for Sunday. Uh-huh. Brian is singing the aria or whatever offering, It Is Enough, which we were just talking about, Lord, Take My Life Away. Mm-hmm. It's chapter 19 of 1 Kings, and I think if you all just reread that and then listen to it sung, it is so powerful, so unbelievable.
So any other thoughts or questions on this? It's a rich couple of chapters.
And Elisha is doing a lot of work with Gentiles, as you said. Mm-hmm. After the exodus, or after the captivity, they realized that God kind of blessed them and was working with the Gentiles.
Yeah.
Just had to be really, we missed the ball.
Yeah, I mean, Elisha was more of a homeboy and less of a traveler than Elijah was. But he spread it around pretty even between Israelites and Gentiles. And, you know, when you make a very exclusive claim on God, the tendency is to mistakenly believe that somehow you own Him. That God is yours. But God isn't anybody's. We belong to God. And I just think that, you know, it's similar to when Jesus, you know, tells the story of the Good Samaritan. You know, two people pass by, and you get to number three, and it's a Samaritan. And they hated Samaritans, absolutely hated them. They were the scum of the earth. They didn't associate with them at all because they had a lot of differences about, well, what is Scripture and what is not, and where should you worship, and a whole host of different things. And, you know, and there was a lot of history there, some of it connected with the exile. But the Samaritan's the hero of the story. And if we don't let God work through us, He'll find some other way. I mean, I think sometimes churches make the claim that they're the end-all, be-all if you want to be in a relationship to God. But when we as church aren't getting the getting the job done, God will figure out another way. Well, it's just about 11, so...